The Man Hong Kong International Literary Festival, Chu Si Te, is a Malaysian author, is going to be talking about writing in a foreign tongue, the attractions of English. The day after that, St. Patrick's Day, we're going to talk about Tibet. Kate Saunders from the International Campaign for Tibet is going to come talk about this year's anniversary of the Dalai Lama's Great Flight. That's going to be Tuesday at 12:30. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs ain't going to like that. We also have a seminar on accounting scandals and detecting financial irregularities. Very topical. That's going to be Tuesday afternoon, 3:30 to 5:30. And I think that's open to everyone, journalists, correspondents, members, but you do need to make a reservation for that. Thank you all for getting up early for this Brilliant at Breakfast event. A couple apologies. Francis Moriarty isn't very brilliant at breakfast. When I talked to him about 10 minutes ago, he was heading to the shower, and I'm not sure what Anna Healy Fenton's excuse is. But Jonathan Fenby made it, and that's all that matters. You, of course, know him as the former editor here of the South China Morning Post. Before that, he worked for, I think, just about every newspaper title in the UK. But most importantly, to me, as a fellow South China Morning Post alumnus, he has proven that there can sometimes be life after the South China Morning Post. He's gone on to write a number of very successful books, the most recent of which is The Penguin History of Modern China, which came out in hardback last year and is just out in paperback. So, Jonathan, welcome back to Hong Kong. He's going to speak to us for about 20 minutes or so, and then we'll open up to the floor and try and wrap up around 9:15.
Good. Thank you, Tom. I'll give up there. Micro. Is that better?
Yep.
Right. Golly, I've used up 1 minute already. No, I thank you for turning out so early. I know some people, mainly sitting at that table down there, go jogging for 5 miles before breakfast and keep very fit. And also, I must warn you that they're preparing their shoes there, ready to throw at me in bush fashion if I say anything bad. I just hope they have one my size. I do need a new pair. Brilliant at Breakfast is a rather intimidating title. I thought this was a series of talks, but apparently it's a one-off. So, first of all, as a journalist, we tend to work late at night, and breakfast is taken when you feel like getting up, and when it's ready. I'm reminded of the occasion in the late 50s when probably the greatest jazz photograph ever taken was taken of about 50 leading jazz musicians on a street in Harlem. And they were all rustled up by Esquire magazine for this at 10 o'clock in the morning. And as Bud Freeman, the tenor player, said, most of the guys here don't know there are 2 10 o'clocks in the day. So I do know there's an 8 o'clock, though. Brilliant, of course, also has been certainly in England, I don't know about Hong Kong, such a misused word at the moment. Everything is brilliant. If you give your credit card to someone to pay for something, the shop clerk will say, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. As if you kind of painted the Sistine Chapel or something like that. And it's now, of course, reduced down to just simply brill. And all the time on the telephone, if you get a number right, people will say brill, 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 which is rather a misuse of the word. And equally, it seems that almost every book which gets praise in a literary page these days, books are no longer good or even very good. They all have to be brilliant or absolutely brilliant or very brilliant. So I'm not sure that I can live up to that. I'm very glad to be here because, in fact, at the corner table on the terrace over there, I had lunch in about February 1995 with a former colleague at The Economist, Jim Roa, who unfortunately died a few years later and was here for The Economist and then with Credit Suisse. And I'd been approached to edit the South China Morning Post. And I came out here, met members of the board. They offered me a contract within 2.5 hours, I think, of my arriving. It was kind of Hong Kong fast, fast style. And I had lunch with Jim on the terrace the next day. And I said, what do you think about this? Is this a good job? And he said, well, in his rather cool, sardonic way, he said, well, you'll enjoy yourself, and unless you're very stupid, you'll make some money, but it won't lead anywhere. Don't think this is going to lead anywhere. So I came here, did the job for 4 years. After 4 years, I think my relations with the owner were such that I certainly didn't expect my contract to be renewed, but I stayed on for another 6 months doing various things, writing a book about Hong Kong, and I kept getting phone calls from the office in Quarry Bay saying, your successor wants to take a few days off. Could you come in and edit the paper for a weekend, which then turned into about 4 or 5 days. And I became known on the news desk as, you know, more return visits, final performances than Frank Sinatra. Not you again, they would say. But, I mean, Jim was right in the first two things. We had a tremendous time, and we did manage to go back somewhat richer than we arrived. One has to be quite stupid, I think, to leave Hong Kong poorer than one arrives. We went back to England and 40% income. Well, it was a bit less. But he was wrong, although neither he nor I could know it, in saying it wouldn't lead anywhere. Because while I stopped editing papers after I'd left Hong Kong, I'd been working as an editor at Reuters, then at The Independent, then at The Guardian, then at The Observer in England, and that's enough editing ed, as it were. Decided not to go back into it when I came. But while I was in Hong Kong, what this time here did lead to was writing books. I'd written 3 books back in the late 70s and 80s and then stopped as I became busy with journalism. But for some reason that I still cannot understand, maybe something in the water, maybe something in the air, although I was responsible for the Post 7 days a week, I sat down and started writing a 450-page book on France. This is a somewhat unusual thing to do in Hong Kong. The only reason I could find was I didn't play golf, so I had some time off at the weekend. And I used to actually get up at 6 a.m. to get work done on that, so that was early breakfast there. And that led to writing a series of books, and I've written 10 books since then, one of them on Hong Kong and 5 of them on China. And also being here, that led me to an involvement and writing about China, and at the moment, as well as books, I run China research at a London-based research company called Trusted Sources. If anybody wants good top-down analytical research, see me afterwards, and I'll have a very advantageous subscription contract waiting for you. But China, I was lucky because when I was here, China was going through an extremely interesting period with the Deng Xiaoping reforms taking shape, then the difficulties that set in during the 90s, the Asian economic crisis, Zhu Rongji using tough measures to deal with those and setting the scene for the upsurge in the economy and economic growth, which took off at the beginning of the 21st century. And I was able to watch that process while in Hong Kong, and then write about it in books, also in magazines, and I do quite a lot of broadcasting on China after I got back to London, while returning often to Hong Kong and to the mainland. And what I've been fortunate, and we were just talking before then, when I look back, nearly everything in my life has been done by other people. I've hardly made a decision myself. I mean, I've decided to do things. And I sometimes wonder, since I was born in the middle of the Blitz, with bombs falling all around, whether even my birth wasn't something of an accident. It's not the time you would normally have had a child. For instance, I became a foreign correspondent. I'd been due to join the Daily Express, who'd offered me a job, and they were then selling 4 million copies a day, and it was a good paper, the Express, at that point, in 1960. I was offered a job. When I rang up and said, when shall I turn up? There was no answer. Nothing happened. Complete silence. And then Reuters offered me a job, so I joined Reuters and became a foreign correspondent, and life went on from that. Years later, I met the recruiter from the Daily Express in a pub in Fleet Street, and I said, tell me, what happened there? He said, oh, yes, I wanted to take you on, but when I submitted your name, it was remembered that your father, my father was an editor and journalist too, had written some very rude articles about Lord Beaverbrook in 1945, and you are on the blacklist. Had that not happened, I might have ended up as, you know, Northeast England deputy sports correspondent for the Daily Express. Who knows? Things do happen by chance, and I came here entirely by chance because I lost my job at the as editor of The Observer one Thursday afternoon. Nasty things happen at nice liberal newspapers, particularly at nice liberal newspapers. And the next day, somebody rang me and said, have you ever thought of going to Hong Kong? And the Post was looking for an editor, and so I came and had the conversation with Jim. And equally much writing about China, I wrote this book about France while I was here, and the publisher, Little Brown, said, we'll publish that so long as you write another book about Hong Kong. It's going to be Tiananmen Square all over again, isn't it? I said, no. They said, oh, well, write the book all the same. And it wasn't Tiananmen Square or that thing, but I did a book on Hong Kong, which was a kind of journal of Hong Kong. Then the publishers, Little Brown, said, as if they were kind of a college careers master, said, well, young man, we'd like you to become one of our authors. Very nice. What would you like to write a book about? So I suggested various French subjects. They said, no, you've done France. There was a long silence. And then the editor at Little Brown and my agent rang me. They'd had lunch together and decided on my future. And they rang me and said, young man, well, not young man, Chiang Kai-shek. And I said, yes, Chiang Kai-shek. And they said, there's no good biography of Chiang Kai-shek. Write a biography of Chiang Kai-shek. I said, oh, I don't know anything. I don't even know how to spell his name. I know absolutely nothing about him. Cash My Check was all I knew, his English nickname. But I went to the China Club, sat in the library, and read about Republican China, and there were a couple of biographies of somewhat out of date of Chiang Kai-shek, and I wrote a book on Chiang Kai-shek, which I say so did well in Britain, but particularly in the United States. And after that, I had four publishers who approached me to write other books on China. None of them were my idea. They were all came from the publisher. But the effect of that is that, if I can use a pompous term, by having been commissioned to do this, I think I've now done a body of work about China, historical and contemporary, which stands, if I can say so immodestly, as an account of how China has evolved and where it has got to today. Having done that and perhaps become more known as a writer than for books than for journalism, I now get people come up to me and said, oh, you've stopped being a journalist, you're a writer. Now, this is rather surprising, because when I was a journalist, I thought I was writing. Perhaps I wasn't. But there is this strange move, we were just talking about with Tom, from you're a journalist or you're a writer. A writer is somehow a superior person who floats on air and doesn't worry about the grubby first draft of history, whereas I regard my books as being essentially journalistic books, somewhat longer, it must be said, than the average SCMP story, but which I'm writing and rewriting and looking at again and approaching a subject, which sometimes I know very little about when I go there, rather like a journalist being sent on an assignment to a country that he or she doesn't know much about. The other strange thing is that people say, oh, you write non-fiction. Now, it's very peculiar to categorize a form of activity by what it is not. It's like saying, oh, the films are not stage works, or running the marathon is not a sprint, and so on. But one is classed as non-fiction. And then within that, if I say, well, I write mainly history, people say, oh, you're a historian. But I'm not a historian, because to be a historian, you have to have at least a PhD, and preferably a university lectureship. And in fact, in London once, I was excluded from a seminar on China at the School of Oriental Studies, because the person organizing this said, your presence would be most unsuitable. You do not have a PhD. So although I'd written and I'd been invited to the thing, there are these strange distinctions there. But I try to, on China, and I'll just say a couple of words about where we are with China today. My feeling is that, first of all, I would say this as somebody writing about China's history, wouldn't I? But I think one has to take into account at least the modern span of Chinese history from the later 19th century to the present day to really understand how the country is evolving and the kind of, if you like, mass psychological tray that are there. Because from the Taiping Rebellion in 1850 to, say, Mao's death in 1976, China probably went through the worst protracted period of any country ever in human history. I mean, it is absolutely extraordinary. The internal wars, the invasions, the famines, the coups, the purges, the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, the whole Japanese experience, and so on and so on. And I think a lot of what is happening today is underpinned by a release, if you like, of the market forces, but that's a release of people since 78, with all the downsides there are to it, and there are enormous downsides. But that past history gives a kind of foundation to what we are seeing today and produces, I would guess, a certain degree of resilience, particularly in the present circumstances. Because if you look back at the period since 1980, more people have been made materially better off in a shorter space of time during that generation than has ever happened in human history before. Now China is going into the second generation of economic reform. I don't expect there to be political reform at all. And in some ways, this will be even more challenging than the first generation, because the accumulated fault lines, everything from corruption, the wealth disparities, pollution, etc., etc., the whole question of what is the Communist Party for, are really building up all the time. And China has to rebalance its economy, it has to modernize its industry, it has to make itself much more efficient. But it's trying to do that on a, if you like, a three, five-year time span, just at the point where the external factors of world demand are hitting it very hard on the chin. And while exports as a contributor to GDP are usually overstated, it's still a motor force for the economy. So China is dealing with, as it were, two challenges, two crises at the same time. Will the government's short-term measures to deal with the immediate crisis actually stop its long-term remodeling of the economy, which needs to be done? And that's the story which trusted sources were following all the time, and I think is the underlying story. And the difficulty at the end of the road is that you still have 800 million workers to find jobs for. And if you modernize economy and make factories more efficient, that means fewer workers. Service industries can go a certain way, but China is going to have a very large population overhang of unemployed people. The latest figures I've seen, the Labour Ministry in a rather unguarded moment said that this was before the 20 to 30 million migrants went home, that China would need to create 24 million jobs this year and that it would actually create 9 million. So you've got 15 million unemployed. What do you do for them? This is a major, not just an economic, but a social problem. And one might fall back on Deng Xiaoping, who once said to Jimmy Carter, "You want some people? 10 million? 20 million? How many? There are too many people in China. This is a big problem." So that has gone very quickly. How brilliant I am, I don't know. But I'll be very happy to answer any questions, hear any comments, have any discussions. And thank you very much for listening. I'll sit down.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fenby. That was wonderful, and we could have gone on for another hour, I'm sure, and asked
I
you.
Certainly could have. I
imagine the audience is brimming over with questions. I am going to field the questions because I think Tom Mitchell has to leave a little bit early. We'll try to stop at 9:30. I know people have to go to work, and if you have to leave, just please feel welcome to do so. So let's just start with the questions right away. Anyone first?
The first one is always.
Yes, all right. Oh, here. That over there. Sorry, hate to point, but
Most of my Chinese friends and colleagues believe very sincerely and very deeply that there's a sort of an institutional bias in virtually every Western media outlet that looks at or reports on Chinese matters. And to an extent that this bleeds over into the academic field when books are written about China or analyses are made of China by people who are not Chinese, don't have a Chinese background. Is this, are they right in this? Are they partially right? Is there any truth to this at all, in your view?
They're right from their point of view, if I can say. But they often, I mean, we're on very thin ice here in some ways, but I think a lot of Chinese people look at China and look at Chinese history, and increasingly so, with a large degree of national pride. And this is particularly the case now, obviously because of economic improvement. And therefore, any criticism from outside is seen as being negative and so on. I mean, when I was at the SCMP, I never had hardly any pressure from Beijing. The pressure came from other sources, perhaps indirectly from Beijing. But the one thing when we were in Beijing and went to see the Hong Kong Macau office, it was always be, Mr. Fenby, why do you report so many negative things about China? Why are you not more objective? There's two problems with this. The first is that it's undoubtedly true. I mean, Western journalism is bad news journalism. The famous story, I was at a conference when I was back at Reuters, and Lou Bacardi, who was then head of the AP, we were all being criticized at this conference for bad news, you know, liking bad news. And he said, look, I'm talking to you at this conference, we're so here today. You'll go home in the evening, and your wife or husband will say, so what did you do today? Oh, I went to this conference, and I listened to these editors droning on, and so on, and so on. But if I die of a heart attack here, the first thing you'll say going home tonight is, guess what happened? This guy died of a heart attack. And it's quite true. I mean, the exceptional is usually the bad news. People have tried to start good news newspapers, and they've usually folded after a week or two. So, I mean, there is that, undoubtedly, from the journalistic point of view, and from what the readers one. From the more historical point of view, I'm not sure that is justified. I mean, it's interesting if you take the case of Zhong Chang's Mao biography. Now, I have considerable issues, as they say, with that book. I mean, there are bits of it that are just plain wrong. And the one pace, everything Mao did was bad, he was incompetent in everything, etc., etc., is a bit wrong, but also not very interesting, misleading. On the other hand, what that book has done, and it's one of the reasons I would say why it eventually got such a trashing from academics, is that for years and years, most of the academic writing about Mao basically let Mao get away with it. You know, there'd be a few sentences saying it was awful, there was this great famine, 30 million people died, there was this, there was that, and so on. But nobody had actually, no academic had got to grips with the Mao thing. And I wouldn't say that academia was particularly skewed in that way. And the interesting thing, a lot of the best writing, I think, in book form about China today, this is a terrible, dangerous. I'm going to an American academic conference on China at the end of the month. I'll probably be barred if they hear I've said this. But I think most of the best writing on China today is actually done by journalists, which tells you more about the place.
That's a very interesting question, because China itself has always been so secretive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's another problem. I mean, you just can't. I mean, historically, you know, where can you get the stuff? If you want to spend your summer in Number 2 Archive in Nanjing, you'll be allowed certain access, but it's pretty controlled still. And as for the last 50 years, no. I mean, it's smuggled stuff rather than anything else.
That's right. Tom, did you have a question?
Yeah, Jonathan, something related to that very interesting question is we've all, I think, in this business been on the receiving end of the official expressions of dissatisfaction with our reporting, what our newspapers are running. But one thing that's really, I guess, changed over the last 2-3 years for me and my colleagues, especially in China, is a transfer of this criticism from official channels to the general public in China. I now receive, on a fairly regular basis, hate mail from people who've read a short translation of one of my articles on our Chinese website. And that didn't happen 5 years ago when I was working in Guangzhou for the South China Morning Post. Do you get the same sort of reaction? What do you think has caused this shift, and what are the implications?
I get probably less than you, but fewer people read me than read you. The FT will be public. No, in Chinese too, so I say. My books are not translated into Chinese. The Chiang Kai-shek book was going to be translated and hasn't been. Somebody came up to me at a publishing party in London about 3 months ago and said, oh, your book, the Penguin History, tremendous book, can I translate it into Chinese? And I said, yes. He said, I'll get it published in the mainland so I could see, you know, 10 million sales coming this way. And I said, but won't there be a few political difficulties in the book? She said, oh, I'll cut that out. So it might be quite a slim book. I haven't heard from her since. No, that's so, but I mean, the reason for it is simply, I think, the opening up of the internet. But I mean, it has become, although sites are closed down and so on, it's an instant means of communication for a lot of Chinese, particularly young Chinese people, who do feel this kind of patriotism. I mean, nationalism, but that's a rather pejorative word, is always the word used for it. I think, you know, pride in the country. And I was in Beijing when there were the protests against the Olympic flame. And you were getting people, and on website, friends were saying in their offices, on the kind of internal website, it was basically, why are these Westerners trying to spoil our party? And there was a feeling of, you know, there is a feeling of, I think, what is it, that, you know, the world is jealous of us and is going to do harm. And that, where does that come from? The patriotic education campaigns of the 1990s, the continuing insistence that all China's troubles in the past were due to the evil foreigners, whereas I would argue, and I do argue in my book, they were mainly due to the Chinese problems themselves. But there's undoubtedly this, and I go to conferences sometimes, and you get supposedly independent Chinese journalists, but who are talking a very nationalist speech.
Well, I think that's very true because the Chinese themselves have a limited access to information about their own country. Okay, more questions? There was someone over here.
There's a lady here.
To the right.
There's a lady here.
Okay, lady here to the right. Yes? There's a microphone
coming. Microphone's coming, I think.
Okay. Oh. Sorry. Would you identify yourselves, please?
Oh, the last one I did, of course. You know, no, I quite the Penguin History is. I mean, it's 900 pages, and it was it would have been about 1,200 pages, but they finally woke up to how long it was going to be, and I chopped 100,000 words out of it. No, I mean that for me, that's quite a good book. Having done books on the imperial dynasties, on Chinese civilization, which I wrote a bit of and edited, Chiang Kai-shek, and a very nice book, which unfortunately is not there at the moment, which I did for a Hong Kong publisher, Formatia, which is Frank Fishbeck, who runs Formatia, that has a wonderful collection of black and white photographs of China from 1850 to 1949. I wrote a 20,000-word text to go with that. It's available in all good bookshops, but for some reason isn't here today. I was, the Penguin book kind of brought all that together. The book, in a sense, the kind of orphan, the little dog who you like and look after, was a book about called The Sinking of the Lancastria, which was about the worst ever British single ship naval disaster, with at least 3,500 people drowned on one troop ship off France in 1940, and Churchill hid the story. Censored it completely, and I came across it completely by chance and found a lot of survivors written down oral memory and so on in collections. And that book is a short book, and it really captivated me writing it. And my wife was there and myself, we sat saying, oh, this is the next Titanic. We could easily spin a love story through this. Kate Winslet could appear. There's a perfect role for so-and-so. There's a perfect role for so-and-so. The book died a complete death.
Go figure about audiences. All right, more questions, please? Yes.
Jonathan, you have a wonderful way of distilling the grand trends of history. I wanted to ask you about the way you see Hong Kong changing over the years since you've been covering it. Now, it's been a little while since I read your book, but on Hong Kong. But from what I recall, it ended on a rather gloomy note. You had sort of the Politburoization of the SCMP and your fights with the owners and so on. And then you kind of leave, and it's as though Hong Kong is on a downward trajectory. So I wonder, you know, whether...
Well, I might have stayed if I had anyone to pay the rent, but staying as a freelance writer in Hong Kong is rather a difficult thing. I mean, I felt, you know, we can argue all day about the pattern reforms and what happened at the time of the handover. But I felt there was, and I'm sure Francis could comment on this too, there was a kind of feeling just before the handover, certainly, and largely I think as a result of patent reform, of self-confidence in the place. You know, finally somebody had given a certain degree of, well, no, it wasn't a responsibility because it was still pretty limited, but people could feel fuller of themselves and more what they should be to a handover. And I think after the handover, with everything, the clock politically at any rate being turned right back as, if you like, the price for preserving the other freedoms of Hong Kong and minimising the Chinese direct involvement, that took, you know, some of the wind, I think, out of the sails of what might have been. The difficulty was that, of course, given the joint declaration, given the Sino-British deal in 1984, it was always going to be like that. And the patent period was a kind of false little mirage dawn that wasn't going to last. And I think that process has just worked itself out with endless delay on, you know, the direct elections and so on. At the same time, I must say, coming back here, and I come back about twice a year, but we arrived on Wednesday evening, and having had dinner with some of the people sitting at that table over there, in the taxi back to the hotel, we thought, this is absolutely wonderful here, isn't it? Could we find a way of returning to Hong Kong? So last night we decided, no, but we'll come more often. But I think, you know, it could have been in a different circumstance. Hong Kong could have grown politically much more and had its own voice much more. But, if you like, part of the deal is that that was never going to happen.
All right. Anyone else?
Actually, can I follow up on that? In terms of, let's challenge Edith's, I think, very appropriate observation of your ability to answer the sweeping historical question. Could you answer one that you raised in your own speech, which is the whole question, what is the Communist Party for?
Ah, well, if I knew, I might become Hu Jintao's main advisor. I've tried to have this discussion with the Chinese ambassador in London, Madame Fu. Strange one, it still calls Chinese women by Madam, not Mrs., like Madame Mao. Madame Fu, she came up to me. I'd been on a panel at the British Museum when they opened the exhibition of the Terracotta Warriors, and the subject was, does the first emperor have any relevance in the present, in the globalized world, which was a rather strange title. But anyway, I talked about China a lot there. And she came up to me at the cocktail party afterwards and said, Mr. Fenby, I have some very harsh things to say to you, but I don't want to spoil the decorum of the evening. And I said, we talked away, and I actually raised this question. I said, look, Madame Fu, if we're going to have a conversation, can you tell me what is the essence of the Communist Party today? And she said, we have always remained true to Marxism, Maoism. It was absolutely boilerplate reply. She did invite me to breakfast about a month later, but it was not to say harsh things. It was for advice on how she could get more publicity in the British press for Hu Jintao's speeches. We said six quick bullet points might do the job, rather than... But the question is, what is the Communist Party for? I mean, at the moment, interestingly, Hu did say in the party plenum in December, or was leaked as saying, that the present economic crisis was the test of the Communist Party's ability to rule, which is the first time I've seen any such statement, that there, you know, there is a test, there is an external validation needed. Has the Communist Party become entirely the vehicle, and I would argue this probably, for the delivery of material improvement, the maintenance of national unity, and the maintenance of social stability, however you define that? Now, if that is the case, and Mao is in the mausoleum, you know, honoured but forgotten about, and I've read somewhere that the new secondary school history and politics curriculum syllabus in Shanghai has one sentence on Mao in it. You know, he's there, but he's being edged out. And also people who do these kind of things have done analyses of Hu and Wen's recent speeches and find the references to Mao are very, very few and far between. Now, if it's become a purely managerial party whose job is to deliver improving living standards, keep national unity, that exposes it to an external test, which it's never had before. And if that is the case, you're actually, I think, entering a new and interesting period where the Communist Party has to define itself. And it's quite dangerous. I mean, if it, lots of unemployed workers join up their protests and you get a kind of unemployed labor protest movement, if Tibet and Xinjiang keep blowing up, if growth falls to 4-5% and so on, that is a real test for the Communist Party. At the same time, I would say the Communist Party, there is an awareness at the top. It needs to reinvent, make itself a much more efficient managerial party in that sense, and get rid of the old dullards, reduce the corruption and so on. But reducing corruption, of course, means paying people more, and whether you're going to get decent wages or not. There's the famous Little Deng, who the arch-reactionary ideologue in the 80s, who is said to have said, this is from Willy Lam, said once, the problem with the Communist Party and corruption is that if we don't get rid of corruption, we're done for. If we get rid of corruption, nobody will join the Communist Party. I'm sure it wasn't quite as pithy as that.
We haven't seen much of them here, fortunately. It's been very good. Other questions, please? Yes.
After that person.
Kathy and then Francis, sorry.
Is this on? Yes. Hi, Jonathan. Kathy Hilborn Feng.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. A couple of questions for you, actually. One, because we see a whole revolution in the journalism industry today, I'm wondering how a former newspaperman like yourself gets your news, how you consume news. And second question, if someone you loved, a granddaughter or someone, came to you and said, I want to be a journalist...
Uh-huh.
In these changing times, what advice would you give to that loved one?
Well, on the first case, I mean, I read the FT religiously every day, because certainly in Britain, it's not only the best, by far the best newspaper. I'm not saying that because you're sitting here. obviously, I'm talking at an FT event later in the day. But also, it's the only one that gives regular coverage of China and this region that you can depend on. But, I mean, like I think most people, I get most of my news, and certainly at trusted sources, where we're all the time following everything. It's a great digest, in a sense, thing. Obviously, through the internet. And, I mean, I just read every day 10 internet sites, mainly on China. I look at the New York Times, I follow The Economist, although I get The Economist in print, but I follow it mainly on there. And my two Chinese colleagues in London just spend most of their time on the internet trawling back. I mean, not just news sources, obviously, but lots of others. My Dian, one of my colleagues, went through 268 pages of Google on China power grid, in Chinese, and she discovered on the 268th thing a posting by one of the ministries as to where the new power grids were going to be built and everything, which nobody had ever found before. And this was a great scoop for us because we were doing something on power, but you have to go through 268 Google pages to get there. She got the weekly medal for perseverance. So it's that, and I mean, I also get a lot of news talking to people, and obviously with historical work, I'm reading endlessly. I'm writing a book about Charles de Gaulle at the moment, and I think I've got 8 books with me, which I'm reading on this tour. And on the historical thing, I was somewhat rude about academics earlier on, which of course I'm not really, because I owe them a huge amount, and I'm a jackdaw who's pulling stuff out of them. But it is extraordinary, you know, where you find your sources. There's an American historian, Catherine Stapleton, who's written a 600-page book about a failed attempt to reform the police service in Chengdu in 1898. And she says in the introduction, this stems from a PhD thesis. I then spent 14 years turning this into a book. Now, I read most of the book, and I've pulled out of it one sentence. That's the kind of magpie I am. And actually, I cut the sentence out when I was cutting the book down there. So it comes from all over the place. As for newspapers, I think newspapers will survive in some sense, but I've felt this for a long time. And we, in fact, launched the SCMP website when I was here before the handover, that you have to see, and I know this is put into effect for some newspapers in a rather heavy-handed way, but you've got to see editorial and writing as a kind of, dare one use the word, database, which some of which will be used in a newspaper, some of which will be used online, some of which will be used in broadcasting. You can't divide up the information anymore. The trick is, can you still keep the specificity of each of those outlets, so they're different. So it doesn't all just become a great porridge site. As for telling which of my grandchildren you're thinking of, we have four to choose from. But if we thought of the oldest one, I'd say you haven't got a chance. You're going to have to become a journalist. Both my parents were journalists. My uncle was a journalist. I grew up with journalists. My wife became a journalist at the BBC. My son grew up saying, if there's one thing I'll never be, it's a journalist. I'd rather be a milkman than a journalist. And he ended up as news editor for CNBC. So they haven't got a chance. It's still a great profession. I mean, it's, as Fats Waller used to say, it's great doing what you enjoy and being paid for it.
Who's going to pay for it if there's no advertising, I think is the question.
Well, the migration of I mean, that's another reason why you have to see it as a whole, because you have to actually see advertising, that you sell some of it into the newspaper, some of it online, some of it on other things. And obviously, I mean, people like me, and I've seen this with a lot of friends who are editors in Fleet Street, it is a very, very difficult cultural thing to do within the newspaper.
True. Big changes. Okay, Francis, you had a question?
Francis Moriarty. My apologies, Jonathan, for arriving.
I understand you had a good shower.
I had a very good shower. Thank you very much. And a long taxi ride. I'm curious what the sentence is that you cut out. First of all, what was the one sentence that you cut out?
Oh, this was saying there was that was the Chengdu police reform. I said part of the 100 days, this policeman was sent to reform the Chengdu thing. He tried it for a year and a half, and then they got rid of him. It wasn't a very interesting sentence. It was just a small for instance.
You may have spoken about it earlier, I don't know. But right now, in terms of handling the economy, China looks rather like the smart guy on the block. So I'm wondering what one should be learning from them in these regards.
Well, I suppose, I mean, on the finance, they haven't had a banking crisis. And they haven't had a banking crisis because the banks are all basically state-owned and in the end do what they're told and will be... They'll get, if they're short of money, they'll get some more money, I'm sure, from the state and so on. But they've avoided that. I mean, I think the pent-up growth, which, okay, maybe the 12-13% growth was overstated in 2007, but they're starting from a fairly high level, and therefore they can absorb quite a lot of pain. And I think there is a resilience, which I was mentioning earlier, which comes in part from getting out of the terrible 150 years that came before economic reform. On the other hand, as again I said, I think, you know, there are huge challenges here which the regime is not necessarily very well equipped, because they're conflicting as obviously things. You need to clean up the environment, quite obviously. But if you clean up the environment, you're going to have to clean up factories, you're going to have to close down polluting factories, you're going to hit a lot of the low labour-intensive, low-margin factories, you're going to have to install expensive, better equipment and so on, and that will perhaps impede growth. So they're dealing with a whole series of conflicting priorities, and I would argue, I mean, I've said this for some time since the party congress at the end of October 2007, that actually Hu Jintao is the weakest ruler we've seen in China since 1949, and he has to rule by consensus. Now, that is a very good thing in the sense of political development, and we don't want mad authoritarian dictators, but it means that actually the decision-making process is slower, more cumbersome, subject to the kind of interest groups and lobby groups that we've seen everywhere. I mean, two examples. Last spring, China was simultaneously running an economic policy of monetary tightening to fight inflation and a realization that they had to get growth going again. So you had two conflicting things going on, representing two different priorities and different groups within the Politburo. And to take another tiny example, at the NPC, National People's Congress, last year, when finally got a transport ministry set up, China had never had an integrated transport ministry. This transport ministry was announced, fine, wonderful, but what is not included in the transport ministry? The railways. Because the Ministry of Railways remains a bastion to itself. And if the government of a supposedly authoritarian one-party state cannot impose itself on its own ministries, which at that point was underspending its budget by 200 billion or whatever it was, you're in a freer, in a sense, political system, but one which is having difficulty, I think, pulling the levers.
All right, it's almost 9:15. Is there one more question? If not, then we will thank Mr. Fenby very, very much for gracing our breakfast tables this morning. And, of course, we will not allow you to get away without the traditional FCC gift.
Well, you're the wine steward, so I
said
the wine representative.
I had nothing to do with this. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much,
Steve.
Could this be a T-shirt? Well, I must tell you that a lady sitting at the table over there brought me one of these T-shirts to London, and I wear it. I can be seen regularly walking around Bloomsbury, not jogging or running, wearing it. So this will be a welcome second one. Thank you very much indeed.
Good. Well, if you're in London, call me
or email
me. And send me Pritchard's.
I'll do that when I'm on the road. Unfortunately, I'm going to miss your FT event today. I've got to head across the border. So.
Oh, well, I hope you have a good meeting up there.
Yeah, all right,
okay. We'll stand here.
Stand here.
Lovely center of Norway away.
It's C.
Yeah.
C, very
you
good.
You have to justify it. You're being there. Give a story.
You're still here.
They can go and practice together. They're going to trip someplace else in the future.
Yeah.
Oh,
cool.
I do my student program.
That was like Robert Marquardt sitting over there.
So it's trusted sources, by
I've not seen in a couple of years, but I've
not heard
of it. Of course, science money is, of course, probably
better than you. Right, that's why I have. Right.
I don't know. Yeah. Oh, there she is.
Yeah, okay.
I heard that you just ran a marathon. Is that true?
That's true.
Awesome.
And then I did the 50K Green Path.
I am so impressed.
And then I did the Disney Walk.
This makes me feel so bad.
Don't feel bad. Join me next time. You got a year to go.
If I tried to run 50K.
Yes. Well, you can walk it if you need to.
Yeah, give me about a week.
They give you 16 hours.
Are you
trying to put the rest of us in geriatrics
to shame? No, I just want to make sure that when I am truly geriatric, that I'm still mobile. So that's why I'm doing it now. You ready to well with?
You? Should I do the whole one?
So, I suppose I better get back to work. I missed my run. What were you doing that you had a shower at the last?
I slept through the alarm, woke up and said, oh God, jumped up. Tom called me and said, are you coming? And I went, shit. And I said, I'm jumping in the shower now, and I head down. Ran outside and it just wasn't a taxi, empty. So I stood 35 minutes in Happy Valley waiting for a taxi.
See, so you could have run it.
I'd be getting here now.
You would have needed another shower, but you could have run it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I tried to call. I did. 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 I
Just put them in a little.
See you.
Take some of those notebooks.
I got so many of them. My suitcase is full of bootsy.